Good afternoon. On behalf of the Intellectual Life Committee, welcome to the final university colloquium of the semester and the culminating event of this year's Come and Read series. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker and her work. I first encountered post-apocalyptic fiction as a seven-year-old when I ran across a battered copy of Tove Jansson's Comet in Moominland in the library. For those who haven't had the pleasure of reading it, it's a story of a small family of trolls coping with the impending disaster and the aftermath of a comet striking their peaceful, rather utopian valley, and it was written by a Finnish author. Since then, I've devotedly read Jansson's translated work. I've been hooked on all fictions, dystopian, speculative, post-apocalyptic, and fantastic. From Margaret Atwood to Ursula K. Le Guin to Octavia Butler. But only when I picked up this year's Come and Read, the beautiful, lyrical Memory of Water, did I encounter another Finnish author, Emi Itäranta, writing in these genres. If you have managed to get this far into the year without reading or at least hearing about the Come and Read, Memory of Water, here's a blurb to give you a taste of it. The world is a landscape of drought and risen seas. A military regime controls the remaining freshwater resources with an iron grip. In the far north, 17-year-old Nuria Kaitio is the last in a long line of tea masters. She must soon take responsibility for a secret carefully guarded by her predecessors. Her family has been caring for a hidden freshwater spring for generations. As the army turns its attention toward the tea master's house, Nuria learns that knowledge and power are irrevocably connected, and that her choices will determine the fate of everyone she loves. Some secrets demand betrayal. Emi Itäranta wrote this debut novel simultaneously in English and in Finnish. It was published to high praise in Finland in 2012, and has drawn comparisons to the works of Atwood and Le Guin. Memory of Water went on to win the Kalevi Jante Literary Prize for Young Authors and the Young Alexis Kivi Prize in 2013, and has been nominated and shortlisted for numerous other awards. Translation rights for the book have been sold to 22 territories to date. It has already been published in Arabic, Czech, Danish, Estonian, French, Georgian, German, Hungarian, Italian, Japanese, Norwegian, Portuguese, Spanish, Turkish, and perhaps more by now. So Emi Itäranta holds MAs in drama and creative writing. She has worked as a columnist, a theater critic, a press officer, and a dramaturge. She comes to us today from Canterbury, England. If you have read Memory of Water and hope to read more of her work, wait no more. The English edition of her second novel, The Weaver, just came out in November. And if, like me, you love all fictions dystopian, speculative, post-apocalyptic, and fantastic, and want to see more of the work coming out of Finland, watch for the anthology, Never Stop, Finnish Science Fiction and Fantasy Stories, compiled by Emi Itäranta and forthcoming in August. Now, please help me to welcome Emi.
Thank you. I was going to do a short introduction of myself, but I think you said everything I could have possibly said, so I don't need to do that anymore. So, good afternoon. It's lovely to see you all here today. I'm here to talk about my book, Memory of Water, and in particular about the research and science behind it, because when I asked, would you like me to focus on the writing process or would you prefer me to talk a bit more about the science of water and water resources, I was told that it would be nice if I can put the emphasis on the science, so that's what I will do. But I would like to emphasize that I'm not a scientist. I'm a fiction writer. So I'm going to talk about the book and the research very much from a storytelling point of view. That said, also includes the research, because I believe that especially when we are writing in genres set in fictional worlds that are significantly different from our reality. It's particularly important to get the research right, to get the details right, to get the science right, so that the fictional world we are portraying is consistent and coherent, because that's the only way it will be credible for the reader. And I therefore invested quite a lot in the research while writing this book. Sorry, I've completely lost my train of thought now, but but I'm sure it will come back to me. Now, before I proceed any further, I'd like to ask you, how many of you have actually read Memory of Water? Right, okay, is there anyone who has not read it? Okay, there are a couple of, okay, a few people. It's fine if you haven't. I only ask because I don't want to spoil the plot for anyone who has not read it and may want to do so. So because there are a few people here who have not read it, I'm going to try to keep my discussion of the plot spoiler-free as much as possible. Right. So I am going to talk first a little bit, actually, for those of you who have not read the book, first a brief synopsis. So it's a story set in a future world, and it focuses on a young woman who is studying to be a tea master under her father's guidance. It's set in a small village in the far north, in an area that today would be a part of northern Finland or Finnish Lapland, but in the fictional reality of the book, set in the future, it's part of something known as the Scandinavian Union. And the Scandinavian Union is an area which is occupied by the more powerful state of Nutian. And the main character, Noria, comes of age at the beginning of the story, and she's given the responsibility for protecting a secret freshwater source that her family of tea masters has been guarding for generations. And it's a dangerous responsibility because the military government in her area is trying to get their hands on all remaining freshwater resources, including this spring. So the story is very much a coming-of-age story that revolves around Noria's choices, as she must decide if she's going to help other people in her village because they are suffering due to lack of fresh water, and at the same time she would risk revealing the location of the spring. Or is she going to just keep the spring a secret and watch other people suffer, knowing that she might be able to help them? So it's very much about growing up and taking the responsibility for your community, for other people, and for the larger world around you. When I started writing Memory of Water, it started with an image which combined two very separate things. I had been reading about climate change and its impact on freshwater resources because that concerned me and that interested me. And around the same time, I was also very interested in Japanese tea culture, particularly what is usually translated into English as Japanese tea ceremony. And these two completely separate things combined in my mind one day into one image. I saw a young woman in a future world preparing tea for herself in a very traditional, almost ritualistic manner, with the last remaining drop of water that she still had left. And I didn't know anything else about the main character or the world she lived in at that point. But I was interested in this image. I wanted to know more about this character. So I started exploring her story and her world, and the story began to grow from there. So while it's a story of tea masters in a dry future world, it's also very much a fictional exploration of the human fingerprint that we are leaving, particularly on water resources, but also on our planet on the whole. And in my research, I focused on two things which were relevant to the storytelling. I learned about myths and beliefs connected with water across different cultures, different philosophies, different religions, because I felt that if I knew something about that, it would give me better tools as a writer to handle it as a subject. And also I felt that it was important that I learned about the science behind the impact of climate change on freshwater resources. And I'm going to talk about both of those now. One of the first texts that I looked at when I started researching the importance and significance of water in different philosophies and cultures and religions was Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. And I'm using here the translation by Ursula K. Le Guin because that's my favorite one. Tao Te Ching is a collection of texts, old Chinese texts, which talk about living a good life, being a member of the community and the society. And although some things about it are very much rooted in its own era, it was written thousands of years ago, some things about it are very universal. And one of the things that interested me about it was that the image of water and the imagery of water recurs throughout Tao Te Ching. It's used as a metaphor for different things in life and about being human. And I chose this quote because this quote in particular became very important to me while I was writing Memory of Water. So it's from an excerpt called Water and Stone, and it says, "What's softest in the world rushes and runs over what's hardest in the world." And that could be interpreted in a number of ways, but to me it speaks specifically about being resilient while also being flexible. It speaks to me about a kind of peaceful, non-violent resistance at the face of aggression and violence. And I felt that I wanted to write a main character for whom this would be something of a guiding, a guidepost or a guiding light, because a lot of young adult fiction, which Memory of Water sometimes also gets classified as, has main characters who are very much outgoing, active warriors. They go with their bow and arrow and they go into the battle and they bring down a dictatorship or an evil regime. And that's fine, I love those stories, but I wanted to write about a different type of main character, someone whose battles are more internal than external, but her resolve and her understanding of what's right and wrong is no weaker because of that. It's just simply that her strength is different kind. So I felt that when shaping Noria and learning about her, this quote became very important to who she was and where the story was going. And once I started looking more into the imagery of water across different texts, I realized that actually some of the best known, most universally known, most widely spread myths and stories are connected with water. And they talk specifically about how important water is, both in terms of life and death, how there is a connection between life and water, but also death and water. And when talking about the connection that life and water have, I realized that it's an image that recurs often in creation stories and creation myths. We probably know best the creation story in the Bible. We know that the Bible begins with the world being covered in water and God's spirit moving over the water and then creating things in the empty world. But that imagery is actually similar, parallel images can be found in many many creation stories and myths in different parts of the world. And I'm going to use as an example the Finnish creation story, which has been passed on in Finnish oral storytelling tradition, because I think that probably most people here wouldn't be familiar with it, and also because it strikes me that the imagery is very similar to many other creation myths. The Finnish creation story talks about an ocean that covers everything before the beginning of all time in the world. And there is a wise old man who floats in the ocean, and there's nothing else. And then a bird descends from the heavens and lays an egg on the man's knee. And the egg is so hot that it begins to burn the man's knee, so the man begins to move in discomfort. And the egg rolls into the water and breaks. And from the parts of that egg, the sun and the moon and the stars and the solid land are formed. And this similar kind of imagery recurs in practically all continents in many different cultures in some shape or form. There are many Native American storytelling traditions that have a similar type of creation myth. The Ainu people in Japan have a similar one. The Komi peoples in Northern Asia, in the Ural area, have another one which is very close to this, about an ocean covering everything and then spirits creating life and solid earth from that emptiness. So that to me talks on a sort of intuitive and emotional level about how there can be no life without water. And also the flood myth is another story where water plays a very significant part and which recurs in many different cultures, in many different shapes and forms and variations. Again, we probably know best the flood story, the story of the Great Flood in the Bible. But there are many versions and variations of it which are very similar, and they usually all have the same basic elements. So there is always an angry or disappointed God who wants to wipe out all life on earth because he's disappointed that people are evil and cruel and not treating each other and the world well. So he decides to send a great flood, but there is always one good person who gets a forewarning. In the Bible, it's Noah. In the Greek mythology, I think he's called Deucalion. And I can't remember what his name is in other versions of the story, but he's always there. And it's because he deserves to live, and he's given a forewarning so that he can save himself and his family and the animals from the flood. That's how life on Earth is able to continue after it has been nearly wiped out. So this myth talks about water not just as a life-giving thing, but also as a destructive and uncontrollable force. So again, it's another story that talks about how we universally, across different cultures, understand the powers of water in a very similar way. Likewise, practically all major religions have central rituals and practices and symbolic values connected with water. In Christianity and Judaism, baptism is practiced in some shape or form to initiate people into the religion and to make them part of that community. In Shinto religion, there is a ritual for purifying and cleaning yourself with flowing water before you step into a temple. I visited Japan last year and I was taught how to do this because stepping into the temple as a Western tourist, I could have been forgiven for not doing it, but I wanted to learn how to do it because it felt disrespectful not to follow that tradition. Also, in Hinduism, Ganges is considered a sacred river, and people go and wash themselves with the water and bathe in Ganges in order to purify themselves, not just physically, but also spiritually. So, and I could go on. But again, what I'm getting at with all this is that water is one of the most universally recognizable symbols. No matter what our background is culturally, no matter what our religious background is, and therefore, from a storytelling point of view, it's a very rich source to draw from because practically everyone can relate to it on some level. Now, I knew that I couldn't only rely on talking on reading about myths and legends and beliefs connected with water, but I also had to look into the hard science of it. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. So we know the basics. We know that a water molecule is made up from two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. We know that up to 60% of an adult human body is water. And practically in all life forms known to us, water is a part of them. In some species, I think jellyfish, for instance, they are about 90% water. So those are the things that we know, and obviously a few others. But there are also things that we do not know. We don't know for certain where Earth's water came from. There are a couple of theories about it. For a long time, the theory that had most support in the scientific community was that the water that we have on Earth today actually came from outer space, that when Earth was formed and the solar system was young, it was nothing but a dry, lifeless rock in space. And at that time, collisions with comets and asteroids were fairly frequent, on a cosmic scale speaking. It was because of those collisions that Earth got its water, because the comets and asteroids had ice on them. So when they collided with Earth, the ice came with them, and due to the proximity of the sun, the ice began to eventually melt, and that's how the seas were formed. And that was for a long time the theory that most scientists would subscribe to. But more recently, there seems to be evidence that actually the water may have been on Earth from the beginning. So when Earth was formed approximately 4.5 billion years ago, the water actually was formed at the same time with the rock. So it was always a watery planet, and that's what enabled life to begin on Earth. Now, we know that without water there wouldn't be life on the planet, but also the shape and form that life on our planet has taken has very much been defined by the global water cycle. So that refers to how water evaporates from the seas and lakes and streams and forms clouds and then rains back and so on. So the global water cycle is necessary for all life. Plant life needs it, animals need it, and therefore humans need it as well, because obviously humans need plants and animals to build shelters, to eat, to clothe themselves in cold weather. So life as we know it today is what it is because of the global water cycle. But now quite recently, no one will be able to say exactly how long, but the past few decades, it seems that the global water cycle is actually changing due to human activity. So what that means in practice is that, for instance, rainfall patterns are changing. The trend seems to be that areas that used to already get quite a bit of rain are getting even more of it, little by little, and areas that were not getting that much rain to begin with are getting even less. So therefore, floods and droughts are becoming more common. Jet streams are also changing. Jet streams are fast-flowing streams of air in the atmosphere, and they have a big impact on weather patterns. So what happens is that the jet streams are not moving as fast as they used to. And what this means for weather is that, for instance, when a few winters ago in the United Kingdom there were massive floods in some areas, it was probably because the jet streams got stuck over the North Atlantic, and therefore rainy weather got stuck over certain parts of the United Kingdom, which meant that those parts got a lot more rain than they would in an average year. And there were huge floods that created a lot of damage to property, people's homes, communities, and basically that damage is still being repaired today. Another way that the water cycle is changing, river deltas, fewer rivers reach the sea now than used to. And this is in part due to the changing rain patterns, but it's also in part due to the fact that we have actually diverted a lot of streams. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, about one third of all available freshwater resources have been diverted by humans for agricultural purposes and other purposes. So that's changing the natural patterns. And sea level rise, this is actually something that I admit I had not thought of before I came across this while doing research for Memory of Water. I'm sure we can all imagine all sorts of consequences to sea level rise, but one that I had not thought about was that actually when sea levels rise due to climate change and global warming, the salty water from the seas will contaminate some aquifers which are near the coastal areas. So that means some freshwater resources that we have available to us now will be lost because of the salt water from the seas. And this will take me, the changes in the water cycle will take me to the next thing that I want to talk about, which is also something mentioned in the title of this talk. And by the way, I realized I should have said at the very beginning that I'm sure you can hear English is not my first language, so I apologize for any mistakes that I make with pronunciation or grammar, and I hope you can bear with that. So I want to talk a little bit about the Anthropocene. And in order to tell you what the Anthropocene is, I first need to explain what a geological epoch is. So a geological epoch is a very long period of time, as in tens of thousands of years, that leaves detectable traces in the strata record. And what that means in practice is that if we were to drill through layers of rock and get to the layer that was created, say, 20,000 years ago, we would in that layer find traces from that time. We might find that would tell us something about life on Earth at that time. We might find fossilized plants, for instance, or fossilized animals, and that would tell us something about what life on our planet used to be like. And officially, we are currently in the Holocene epoch, which most scientists think began approximately 11,700 years ago. And the Holocene epoch is characterized by a relative stability of climate, and also the sort of rise of human cultures and civilizations, because all human history as we know it, all human civilizations as we know them, are encompassed by the Holocene epoch. But now, within the past 20 years or so, I would say, more and more scientists have come to believe that we may actually have entered a new geological epoch. We may be either entering it now or it may have already happened. And this new geological epoch is characterized by human activity and the traces that human activity leaves in the strata record. So basically, if someone were 20,000 years in the future, someone were to drill again through the layers of rock into our time, they would find marks left behind by us. They would find fallout from nuclear tests, for instance. They would find toxic chemicals from our industries, and they might also find some plants, fossilized plants and animals that but they might as well find a can of Coke. So that's the sort of thing that we are now leaving behind, and it's very distinct from any other previous geological epoch, because previously the human mark and the human fingerprint on the planet was simply just not as strong as it is now. So the suggested name for this new geological epoch is the Anthropocene. And for more examples of this human impact on the planet, one of the most obvious ones is climate change, which includes global warming and extreme weather phenomena, which I already mentioned, like droughts and floods and hurricanes, for instance. Another example is the plastic pollution of oceans. You have probably heard of the garbage patches floating in the Pacific, and also the microbeads, which are accumulating in the systems of sea animals and might very well end up on our plates one day. Also, toxic chemicals, which can now be found practically everywhere. Within the past few months, there was a scientific article published about how some toxic, potentially dangerous chemicals were found in the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of any ocean on Earth. And basically that means that there is no place on Earth anymore which is safe from human impact. Even the most remote place is now bare a fingerprint that we have left on it. Yet another example is coral bleaching caused by the acidification of the oceans, particularly the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is in very bad shape at the moment. And it's not just the coral animals dying, but it's actually having a huge impact on the whole ecosystem. And that takes me to the next example, because it's included in it. We are currently in the middle of an extinction wave, a wave of mass extinction, and some people have named it the sixth extinction, because we know of five previous mass extinctions throughout all geological epochs of the planet. And the sixth one that we are in the middle of now is different from the previous ones in the sense that the current one is mainly caused by human activity, unlike the previous ones. So from this, looking into all this while doing my research for the book, I could not help asking myself, have we actually become the main antagonist? Have we become the enemy of the planet that we live on? And it's probably not a question that any writer wants to ask themselves, but after all this research, I couldn't help it. And that was also one of the things that shaped Memory of Water very much. But I don't want to finish on a very bleak and hopeless note. So I think it's worth thinking about and looking at what we can actually do. Is there any action that we can take? And I do think that there is. And now what I'm going to say here is my personal opinion. There are going to be other views. But the way I see this is that our approach to how we use natural resources has been for a long time, for centuries, very much defined by the idea that we are somehow separate from nature, that we are somehow disconnected from the nature around us, and that we are somehow above nature and therefore entitled to exploit natural resources however we please. I see the roots of this thinking in the Enlightenment era, in the 17th century, which coincided with Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution gave us tools to shape the planet in ways that we had never seen before. So it created this way of thinking where wild nature was seen as something to be tamed and controlled through human technology and human intelligence. And that thinking extended well into the Victorian era. And it has been this approach to natural resources has been used to justify all sorts of things that are not necessarily justifiable. And I personally think that adapting to the new geological epoch that we are standing on the edge of now, adapting to it and actually surviving the changes that our planet is going through requires a complete shift in thinking. I think that rather than seeing nature as something to be exploited and profited from, we should begin to see it as something to be cherished, and also instead of seeing ourselves as separate from it, we should see ourselves as part of the cycles of nature. Because as long as this is the only planet where we have to live, we cannot really separate ourselves and our lives from the rest of the planet. It's just simply not possible. So therefore, I think in order to survive the changes that we have caused, our own actions have caused, we have to be able to take the responsibility for our own choices and their consequences and see ourselves as part of what is going on rather than separate from it. I think that this shift in thinking, if it happens, and I do think that it will happen, perhaps very slowly, but it will, I think that potentially can and will create a movement towards a more sustainable lifestyle. Another thing that is worth remembering is that we can use our voices as consumers and citizens. We are not entirely powerless there. Big corporations in particular are very interested in turning a profit. So if we get together and tell them, you know, if you don't create a proper recycling system for your plastic bottles instead of dumping them into the oceans, we're not going to be buying your products anymore. And they might not listen, but they might very well have a reason to listen because it is in their own interests. So it's worth remembering that this is something we can do. Also, as citizens, we can use our voices and our votes to vote for politicians who are more interested in creating sustainability than basically just defending their own interests. I would love to be able to say that there is some kind of magic trick or quick fix, something that we can do and it will make everything better. But unfortunately, that would not be true. So it's going to be, whatever we do, it's going to be long-term hard work. There's no getting around that. But that said, I have a lot of faith in humans because throughout our history as a species, we have proven ourselves to be resilient, we have proven ourselves to be adaptable, we've proven ourselves to be imaginative and creative and problem solvers. So we can do all of those things. I believe that. And I seem to have gone through my talk a little bit faster than while I was rehearsing it. But I want to leave you, before taking questions, I want to leave you with a quote from an author whose work I admire, Toni Morrison. She wrote a fantastic essay called No Place for Self-Pity, No Room for Fear. And she talks here specifically about being an artist and the importance of artists' work in difficult times. But I think what she is saying applies to everyone, whether regardless of whether you're an artist or a scientist or a student or a teacher, if you're just a human being trying to find some hope in difficult times, I think what she says applies. And this is what Toni Morrison writes. This is precisely the time when artists go to work. There is no time for despair. No place for self-pity. No need for silence. No room for fear. We speak. We write. We do language. That is how civilizations heal. I know the world is bruised and bleeding, and though it is important not to ignore its pain, it is also critical to refuse to succumb to its malevolence. Like failure, chaos contains information that can lead to knowledge, even wisdom. So I will leave you with that. And now, if anyone has any questions, I will be very happy to take them. About the book, about the research, about the science. The science is not my greatest strength, but I will try to answer if I can. Yes?
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of us are involved locally with people concerned about these things, and I'm more in despair, not about if we'll find solutions, but about that so we see all the same faces at all the events.
Yeah.
And so I'm really glad that artists are helping get these ideas, but it just seems like so many people don't understand that the house is burning, that there's a problem. Can you just address that?
That's a very difficult thing to address, because I struggle with the same thing. When I go and travel and talk about these things, I feel that it's always the people who are already thinking about all this, thinking about their responsibility, who come to the events. So I have yet to find a way to build the bridges and actually get the message through to the people who either don't care or are too busy to think about it or whatever. Everyone has their reasons. I would like to think that storytelling is one of the ways to go, because it's something that we as human beings have in common. Storytelling is something that all cultures have in some shape or form. So I believe it's something that is very universal to being human and understanding our life and our experience on this planet. So I think that talking through stories and fiction might many times be a more effective way than just stating the facts. That doesn't mean the facts don't matter. The facts matter greatly, and I think we should defend them, especially in times when some people would rather just ignore them. But I think that I have no answer for you how to do it. But I think that we have to speak to people's emotions and to their values as much as to their thoughts. I think it's only when these two things are combined that people feel that they can connect to an idea both on a rational level and an emotional level that talks to the values that are important to them. I think that's where we make the change. But I don't know how to do it. I'm sorry, I wish I knew. Any other questions? Yes?
This is a bit more from the literary point of view, but it's related to the question of access, which I think is a really big part of the story. Who has access, and how is that access gained or lost? And when I was reading your novel, I thought about Margaret Atwood right away, but I also was thinking about Jean de Foret. I don't know if you're familiar with the story about the French farmer who has a hidden spring.
Oh, yes, I know that one, yes.
So,
yes.
And that's set, you know, in the, I think, early 20th century or late 19th century. But it's also a question of access.
It is.
And so the thing that was really intriguing to me and troubling was the way this story sort of held up the realities of control and the political or economic forces that limit the use of what we have. I'm not sure what I don't know if I have a question.
Okay.
As just a thought from your perspective in not giving away the novel, I wondered whether there was some actual challenge to the access that Nuria faced by the choices that she made. Did that really, as you were thinking about the story, did her choices push back on that access question?
Yes, yes, that's right. I mean, in some ways, Memory of Water is also a story about privilege, because Nuria comes from a privileged background. She's not aware of it at the beginning because she's lived a very sheltered life, but that's part of her growing up, coming to realize her own privilege when she sees it juxtaposed with other people. And it's a difficult dilemma because if she does allow other people access to the water, she's risking it for all of them. She's risking that they will all lose it. But if she doesn't allow it, she's keeping to her own small privileged ivory tower and not helping others whose life might depend on it. I wanted to tell a story where there are no clear-cut choices of right or wrong. Nuria is a character who has a very strong, I think, has very strong ethical and moral values, but it doesn't mean that the choices are going to be clear-cut or easy. Yes?
I'd like to build on that question a little bit, because it seemed plausible to me that in a situation where there was a shortage of something that was essential for life, that some kind of totalitarian government or totalitarian control would take place. And I think many readers would probably like say right away, yes, that's reasonable, that would happen. But I'm trying to remember, it's been a few months since the book.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what you included from the science that would make such an intense doubt plausible to people. Where did you build that in, if you could remind me?
Right. It's not okay. When I talked about the science, it doesn't mean that the science is spelled out in the book. It just meant that I looked into these things as background research, so then they could filter through the writing process to create a fictional story. So I don't think the book. Do you mean what led to the situation?
Yeah, it's kind of mysterious.
Yeah, it is.
Gradually,
yes.
Shortage of water. And
that's right. No, I don't. You probably didn't miss something, because there was one deliberate choice that I made towards the end of the writing process. I had an earlier version of the story in which it was explained in a lot of detail how the world ended up where it is in Memory of Water. It talked a lot about the background and the history and what led to this situation. But my writing group, who was reading the story as I was writing it, read that part, and they said, you know, you have an info dump here. We don't need all this information. It is implied. So, you know, we already know enough about these things without you detailing it in, you know, 15 pages. No one is going to read this. So essentially, I listened to them, and I left out most of the backstory where the scientific part was explained. So in my mind, what happened was that there was that basically due to climate change, the sea levels rose a lot, and the rainfall patterns changed a lot. So a lot of areas that were not suffering from droughts before started to have droughts, and a lot of land that previously was there was left underwater. So people had to live in smaller areas, which also created a lot of climate refugees. So that's the basic gist of it, that there's just less dry land to live on and less fresh water available. Okay, thank you.
And yep. Follow on this question,
yeah.
We are within decades right now of exhausting the Ogallala Aquifer in the United States, which is as big as one of the Great Lakes, and it's about 90% exhausted right now. And it supplies water for irrigation of about 35 or 40% of American crops. That's not very far away. The other piece, which I think could happen very quickly and would affect this country exercise before we get rid of all of the Rocky Mountain snowpack that falls in the wintertime. And that's the only thing that makes survival possible in the summertime for a lot of the American Southwest and for about, and when it comes to the Himalayas and the four great rivers that come down through Asia from the Himalayas.
Yeah.
That's, there's something like 2.5 to 3 billion humans that are dependent upon that for life. I don't think it's very far off at all.
Unfortunately, I think you're right.
I have a question. Totally switches the game. You tie mythology and ritual into her life early on. Is there a possible mythology and ritual that would, because part of what you suggest is that mythology affects our way of approaching this, is there another mythology or ritual that would make us think differently? When we attempt to do it only with saying this water's going to disappear, it becomes, it's still this American binary of good, bad, you're either on this side or your side. Is there a ritual or a mythology that would recapture our imagination that when I go drink that glass of water, my ritual is different and I,
I can't think of one right now. It's quite possible that there is something like that, but I can't remember coming across it. I think it may be something that is yet to be created, that maybe we have to create these myths and stories and rituals for ourselves in order to change our approach to water and other natural resources. Maybe we have to start telling ourselves a different story than what we've been telling ourselves for the past few hundred years.
I have a sort of a response to that, but also I'd just like to offer what I see as another sort of link. If we all know people who just haven't quite grasped it or don't quite care, over the past year, my family has dealt with the tragedy of health, demising health in our young daughter. And now she's beautiful, now she's fine. And I've come to believe, we have treated her outside of the medical model. And I have come to believe that her sickness, like that of many, many other people in this country and across the world, all of the diseases of inflammation, all of the autoimmune diseases, cancers, diabetes, obesity, I've come to believe that many, many of those diseases are directly related to the toxicity in our environment. The particles of industrial chemicals and agrochemicals in our water and in our food and in our air and the ground that our children play in at parks. So I think I don't think that the research on that, there is research, but it's not celebrated research, and because of the way medicine is compromised by the interests of pharmaceuticals, the research isn't adequate. But I think if we can teach people, and some people are convinced when you talk about things like asthma, they see a connection, breathing difficulties, air pollution, it's more obvious. But I think that if we can teach people that we're getting sick, our bodies are, it's not just the planet, it's not just ecosystems over there, we are getting sick, our babies are getting sick. And that's a link. And related to the ritual, I think a lot of indigenous cultures still do this and have done it, but part of our family's journey, I have grown to be so much more grateful and appreciative of water that is pure, of food that is pure, and being mindful of that when I'm drinking it and when I'm eating it. And I'm not an expert on these other cultures, but I think that I've heard enough and I've read enough in snippets that, you know, just a gratitude, the ritual of gratitude, and ownership, which ties into what you were saying about it's us, we are nature,
Yeah, thank you. I think gratitude is a really, really important point here, because I think part of the problem is that we tend to take our natural resources and everything we have for granted. It's only if we have to question it, if we don't have access to all those things, that we begin to appreciate them. So I think gratitude is a very, very important thing here, and it's something that we should probably practice on a daily basis. I try to do that. When writing this book, I became very aware of how little I understood about what it is to live a life where you don't have some basic resource. I grew up in Finland. It's a country with huge freshwater resources per capita. I never had to think about my water use when I was younger, when I lived there. Now I try to remember every day that water is not necessarily something I can take for granted. For a lot of people, it already is something that they can never afford to take for granted. So yes, gratitude, very important. And maybe, yes, as a ritual, like you said, a simple ritual that we can practice every day.
Just a thought, a memory I wanted to share. I once stayed at a guest house in Haiti that was simultaneously a guest house for tourists and among her street boys who were recovering. And as a guest house, they decided, instead of using pumps to pump water into the guest house,
right,
they were going to carry water up 5 flights of stairs as a strategy to bring home the value of that.
Yes, yes, it makes sense.
This is maybe asking Jerry's question in just a different, slightly broader way, but one of the interesting themes to me in the book was the relationship between religion and science. I don't think you really posed it as a conflict, but Murray, choosing between the other fathers, kind of choosing religion over science, which he says is connected to science and technology, which is your best friend. I'm just curious, as you're thinking about how we approach this, well, posing the scientific problem, what's the role of
You're asking a very difficult question. I don't see science and religion as mutually exclusive at all. I actually think that there is a lot of potential there for them to work together. And it was something that interested me. Like you said, the mother and father, they represent two opposite views, and I felt that Noria should have that parents who come from different different sides, look at the matters from different sides, and she has to find her own way. In a way, I'm going to say something about my personal history here, because I think it's relevant. I was brought up in Finland. I was brought up Lutheran because that's the main religion in Finland. And I remember at school when people would ask, the pupils would ask the teacher, how do you fit together? This is what it says in the Bible, and this is what we know from science. These look like different things. And she explained that maybe we should look at religious texts not literally, but as symbolic, as talking about value and emotion and intuition rather than fact. So I think that those two things can be fit together. I don't have an answer for you how to do this, but I do believe it's possible, and I do see, I mean, I know scientists who are also very religious. They don't see any problem there. They don't see a contradiction. So I think these two things can be combined. Yes?
Perhaps that dilemma is changing in our time. I mean, historically, science gave humans the ability to conquer nature, or at least this was a big story. It goes back a few centuries now. Science is now telling us a different story.
Yes.
That we are part of nature, nature is part of us, and we disregard that at our own risk. And the scientists from all over the country who will be marching in Washington scientifically based policy, which is
absolutely
the story in our government,
yes,
about why these things matter, rather mm-hmm. than money is the most important mm-hmm. thing, and it's not worth it. It's a waste of money if mm-hmm. the president is not saying to pay any attention to these mm-hmm. things. It's really an argument, as you say, about what story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I think science, as we understand it, it maybe doesn't have the same status today as it used to have, and we need to elevate it back there as something to be considered and something that actually matters. Okay, one final question. Yes, I am working on a third book. My second one came out last year in English, and now I'm writing a third one, which is, I seem to be attracted to ecological themes, so I'm talking once again about the environment. In my third book, Earth has become partially uninhabitable, so people have actually colonized other planets, and some people have moved to space. That's really all I can say about it at the moment, because it's fairly early days. Was there another final question, or shall we finish here? Okay, if there are no more questions, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for the conversation.
Thank you. And everyone, thank you for the rich questions. And we can feel free to continue the conversation out just outside. There's going to be a reception, and you can have a chance to talk more with Emmy and with each other. And I also want to just put a little commercial up for next year's Common Read and invite community members and members of the university community to join us as we read together Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. So we're bringing our exploration of communities and dystopias a little closer to home in this moving personal account of what it's like to be Black in America. It's written by Coates as a letter to his teenage son. And we have more colloquium events coming up next year, so stay tuned for those. And again, thank you, Emmy. And thank you all for coming.